This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many terrorist groups try to use the media to magnify the scale and importance of their actions. A new documentary examines an early example of this in a case of domestic terrorism. Guerrilla, The Taking of Patty Hearst, tells the story of the SLA, the Symbionese Liberation Army, which in 1974 kidnapped the 19-year-old newspaper heiress and demanded that her father, Randolph Hearst, pay a ransom of $300 million in the form of food to the poor. He tried to comply and organized a food program, but it ended in chaos and riots. Patty Hearst was locked in a dark room for weeks. When she was allowed out of that room, she declared she had become a member of the SLA. She participated in one of their bank robberies, carrying an AK-47. Much of the coverage surrounding the story in subsequent years has speculated about whether she ever really believed in the SLA's cause, or if she was just brainwashed. But the new documentary revolves around the SLA itself, and how it used the media, and how the media helped inflate the power of the SLA. When the group first kidnapped Patty Hearst, one of the leaders of the SLA, who went by the name Sinkew, released this tape.
Randolph A. Hearst is the corporate chairman of the fascist media empire of the ultra-right Hearst Corporation, which is one of the largest propaganda institutions of this present military dictatorship of the militarily armed corporate state that we now live under in this nation. The primary goal of this empire is to serve and form the necessary propaganda and smokescreen to shield the American people from seeing the realities of the corporate dictatorship which Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford represent. In closing, I wish to say to Mr. Hearst and Mrs. Hearst, I am quite willing to carry out the execution of your daughter to save the life of starving men, women, and children of every race. And if, as you and others so naively believe, that we will lose, let it be known that even in death we will win. For the very ashes of this fascist nation will mark our very graves.
That tape is one of the many broadcast actualities included in the new documentary, Guerrilla, The Taking of Patty Hearst. My guest is the director, Robert Stone, and just to clear up any confusion, he's not the novelist, Robert Stone. Also with us is Tim Finley, who covered the story as it unfolded for the San Francisco Chronicle. The paper's competitor, The Examiner, was owned by the Hearst family. I asked Finley to describe the SLA. He said their first act was the assassination of Marcus Foster, the newly appointed superintendent of the Oakland schools. He was the first African American to hold that position.
Foster was a very progressive man with great ideas, and he came up against a very reactionary group of civic leaders in Oakland at the time and promised great things for the school children. The SLA comes along and acting as a so-called leftist organization, kills him when they kidnapped Patricia Hearst. In fact, I didn't know Patricia Hearst had been kidnapped for 2 days after she was taken because the publishers hid that fact from everybody. So Patricia Hearst was woven into the story of the SLA, which I originally pursued as a story of a left gone very, very wrong in assassinating Marcus Foster.
You say that the left was really opposed to the SLA. Why was the left opposed to the SLA? The SLA had used the rhetoric of the left and used the anti-corporate stand, the helping the poor stand of the left for their own purposes.
Mm-hmm. No, that came later. The SLA, you must remember, came along at a time when they were, I would say, greatly infatuated by the left movement since civil rights days and the student movement and now the prison movement, but greatly impatient with the way it was going. The war in Vietnam was over. The big demonstrations had finished. These individuals had not really played a part in that. They wanted a piece of the pie. They saw the revolution as continuing. But if you examine what was truly going on in the left of the time, and in that period of the early 70s, there was a great deal of intellectual study being devoted once again to Lenin and Trotsky and Stalin and really hardcore Bolshevik ideas. The SLA, if you will, came along like the Marx Brothers, and that's really the way they portrayed it. The left, the serious left, wanted nothing to do with these clowns.
Robert Stone, can you talk about how the assassination of Oakland superintendent of schools connected with the kidnapping of Patty Hearst?
Well, shortly after Marcus Foster's assassination, about a month or two later, two members of the SLA, Russ Little and Joe Romero, were arrested in a traffic stop and charged with the murder of Marcus Foster. And the SLA had, you know, they'd studied these guerrilla groups in Latin America, and they'd watched this movie State of Siege, which is all about a political kidnapping. And what they did was they kidnapped Patricia Hearst initially with this idea that they were going to trade her for Russ Little and Joe Romero in sort of some sort of hostage exchange.
Those were the two men arrested for the assassination of the superintendent.
That's right. That's right. So, I mean, it sounds kind of crazy, but in their sort of romantic idea of being the armed guerrillas, they thought they could pull this off. And they quickly realized they couldn't. And out of that sprang this sort of massive sort of Robin Hood demand for Randolph Hearst, Patty Hearst's father, to feed all the poor people of California to the tune of $300 million.
Let me play a tape that you include in your documentary, Guerrilla, The Taking of Patty Hearst. This is a news clip of Randolph Hearst, Patty Hearst's father, reading the kidnap notice that he received.
The United Federated Forces of the Symbionese Liberation Army, armed with cyanide-loaded weapons, served an arrest warrant upon Patricia Campbell Hearst. All communications from this court must be published in full in all newspapers and all other forms of the media. Failure to do so will endanger the safety of the prisoner. Should any attempt be made by authorities to rescue the prisoner or to arrest or harm any SLA elements, the prisoner is to be executed. And in capital letters under that is death to the fascist insect that preys upon the life of the people.
Now, once Randolph Hearst read this kidnap notice, you know, the notice said all communications from the SLA must be followed in full by the media, or that would affect Patty Hearst's safety. Tim Finley, what position did that put the media in? Did you feel that you were now responsible for her life, that if you didn't do what the SLA said, that she would be harmed?
Well, I was in an exceptional position, and in that, I, you know, as a reporter, I was, again, still working on the Foster story, and by then had identified who the SLA was. But the newspaper was refusing to print my stories identifying who the SLA was for fear of harming Patricia Hearst. I had no role in their decision to go ahead and print every word that the SLA sent them. They did ask me what I thought about that. I said I thought it was a mistake. But their reply was essentially the same, is that they would do everything they could to protect Patty Hearst. And it's very hard to argue against that at that point. Although in my case, I was put in an extremely difficult position because I was basically withholding information that my sources had given me, which could have led to their arrest. And my sources were left-wing sources, and we were beginning to suspect that maybe I was not such a friend of theirs after all. Maybe I was working for the police.
What kind of tips were you getting from the left that you had to withhold?
Well, certain people in the left had known these people very well. They told me who they all were. We knew where they were for a time. I had the identity of everyone involved in the SLA and their background.
Are there a lot of sources you're protecting to this day?
Oh, there's a couple of sources, sure, that I'm protecting. You know, I was promised never to reveal. I don't even know where those sources are today. But more than that, it's a matter of to give away the techniques of what had to go on at that time, just to come up with all that stuff. That you remember that the left found itself rather embarrassing to be chasing one of their own in this situation, and yet these people had stolen guns from other people in the left in order to carry out their nonsense and their homicide. They were running around with guns. If they were caught, would be traced back to other members of the left who had nothing to do with it and wouldn't have anything to do with this sort of thing. They had, you know, sources of their own, they thought, within the left, who would give them up in an instant if they got the chance, and they were only gradually learning in the SLA itself that they were in that kind of jeopardy. Since you got radio time, I'll give you a small example. When we finally did publish the story about SinQ and who he was, I included in that story at least five references to his affection for plum wine. Now, I wasn't trying to attack the guy necessarily as a drunken revolutionary, but we were trying to underscore the fact that the source for that information was the source he would recognize through the plum wine connection. And we emphasized that over and over again in the stories just to let them know that we obviously knew more and that the left itself was telling them, you know, stop now, don't go further. And they ignored that.
Well, that's really interesting. You think they got the message? You think they got it? Yeah,
Yes, they did.
My guests are Robert Stone, director of the new documentary Guerrilla, The Taking of Patty Hearst, and Tim Finley, a journalist who covered the story as it unfolded for the San Francisco Chronicle. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Robert Stone, director of the new documentary Guerrilla, The Taking of Patty Hearst, and Tim Finley, who covered the SLA's kidnapping of Patty Hearst for the San Francisco Chronicle. He also wrote a book on the story, and he is interviewed in the movie.
Co-wrote with Les Payne of Newsday, by the way.
Thank you. Robert Stone, one of the things you really focus on in the movie is how the media covered the story, and you get a little glimpse of the difference between the mainstream media and the alternative media's covering of the story. I want to play a clip that you have in the movie, and this is a clip of Paul Fisher at the Pacifica radio station KPFA on day 9 of the Patty Hearst kidnapping, talking to his listeners about a message from the SLA that they had just gotten in the mail.
And what we're going to play next, as per instructions from the SLA, is a tape recording from the SLA which purports to contain the voice of the kidnapped victim, Patricia Hearst.
Mom, Dad, I'm okay. I'm with a combat unit that's armed with automatic weapons. And these people aren't just a bunch of nuts. They've been really honest with me that they're perfectly willing to die for what they're doing. And I want to get out of here, but the only way I'm going to is if we do it their way. And I just hope that you'll do what they say, Dad, and just do it quickly. And I mean, I hope that this puts you a little bit at ease so that you know that I really am all right. I just hope I can get back to everybody really soon.
That's a news clip that is included in Robert Stone's new documentary, Guerrilla, The Taking of Patty Hearst, about her kidnapping by the SLA. Robert Stone, part of your movie is about the media coverage of the kidnapping of Patty Hearst. Standing back from it a little bit, how do you think the media played it, and do you think that the way they played it affected the outcome of the story?
Oh, I mean, the fact that this SLA got the attention they did is what makes the SLA something that we're talking about 30 years later. Otherwise, they would have just been a footnote in history that would have been, you know, forgotten. But I think that's the most interesting thing about this, is how they got the attention that they did, and how really half a dozen people got the attention of the world through this kidnapping. I mean, what you're seeing here is, I think, it's really the beginning of the broadcast news media, at least, sort of merging with the entertainment industry, and almost, you know, an act of political terrorism being played out as a form of mass entertainment for people. So you start off with, you know, the clip that you played that was played on an alternative radio station. That ended up being rebroadcast by the television news media, who were standing in front of the Hearst Mansion holding up radios, and the television cameras were filming the radio. So it filters out there, and then this ended up going out across the country. The communiques were broadcast in full in the newspapers across the country, and it gave the SLA really incredible power beyond this fact that they were just this really tiny group. And they ended up kind of they got into this sort of feedback loop where they sort of bought their own hype, and it sort of fed their own megalomania in a sense.
The rhetoric kept.
They would put out these, you know, they would refer to themselves as soldiers and that they were an army and that they were holding Patty Hearst under the terms of the Geneva Convention. And then Randolph Hearst would start using this rhetoric and the media would start using this rhetoric. And I think they almost came to believe their own rhetoric. They almost came to believe that, well, maybe we are having a huge influence on society. Maybe we really are starting a revolution.
A lot of the media was camped out on the Hearst's lawn. And one reporter who is interviewed in the documentary Guerrilla says, we were being messengers for each side, but nobody was really doing their work as journalists. Tim Finley, would you agree with that? Do you think a lot of the press was being used as a messenger but wasn't out there actually trying to uncover what was going on?
Well, you know, I'll say proudly, I never was on the front lawn of the Hearst Mansion at all.
I figured, yeah.
And I certainly spent a lot of time out there looking for these folks. It's easy. And you got to remember that it also hit at a technological time in that for the first time, many local stations and regional stations were able to put up a live signal, though admittedly it took a big truck. However, this situation fit just perfectly for it. And old-time reporting, frankly, such as we were doing, seemed to be lost in the process. It's okay with me, you know, some loss of competition doesn't hurt sometimes, but I'll give you a good example. There was a television woman reporter who sort of tracked after it for a little while and came along behind us, and she went on television one time, and we had followed these people through the housing projects in San Francisco and knew where they'd been there, and she went on television. She said that the way they survived in the housing project was that they stole wash towels from local service stations and sold wash towels. We couldn't figure what was she talking about. They sold wash towels. And we looked back and we realized what she had heard was that the people in the housing project had referred to them as the watchtower people. That is Seventh-day Adventists, you know, who come door to door knocking on to sell you a thing. The SLA was doing just about that. They were going door to door, knock, knock, knock. Here's the revolution. Can we come in and talk to you if you're not having dinner for a while and see how well you fit within the future for, you know, insurrection and treason? And they started calling them the watchtower people. And she heard that and heard watchtower people. But and I'm sorry, it's an amusing story. But, well, a lot of things like that got carried away. Other people exploited the media into claiming they had a communique when they really didn't, you know, and trying to sell it for money. And there were a lot of offshoot little entrepreneurs running around during the food giveaway program. So it was pure craziness. And again, as you say, most of the media remained camped out on the lawn of the Hearst Mansion as if she would drive up someday in a, I don't know, in a big Volvo or something with revolutionary flags on it. Say, I give up. I don't know. But she never did.
But Hearst fed the whole thing, though. I mean, he felt that was his only power to get his daughter back, is the fact that he controlled all these papers and controlled all these radio stations. That's what he knew. That's the world he knew. So he invited them all onto his lawn.
Well, this was funny. He called me one morning. It was real early, and I live in Sausalito, and I answered the phone, and he said, Tim? I said, yeah, kind of half hungover, half asleep. He said, this is Randy. And I said, right, this is Randy. I didn't believe him. And I said, Randy who? Randy Hearst. He had this idea that he wanted me to help him out. He wanted me to contact all the underground papers in the United States, the heavy left underground press like the Berkeley Barb and so on and so forth, and get them to print a message that he would write and print every word he would write in the underground press. And I said, well, David Hirst, you know, you've got, what, 7 newspapers and 15 radio stations, I don't know, TV stations and stuff, and you want me to get you the Berkeley Barb? I mean, you really think that's going to help? He was convinced somehow that he just needed to get through to her with the right medium. And so, of course, we did, and I don't think they ever made the deal to print everything he said in the Berkeley Barb, but he was desperate for that kind of thing, to find the right approach. He was convinced that if he could just sit down with these boys and girls, he could talk them out of this whole thing.
The first few weeks that Patty Hearst was held hostage, she was, as far as we know, in a closet and was going through...
Well, like a pantry, actually.
Like a pantry, okay, okay. And when she was finally released from that confined space, she had a conversion or pretended to have a conversion or was brainwashed or whatever. There's so many different interpretations of the story. But anyways, she changed her name to Tanya. She started going out with the SLA. She joined them in a bank robbery. She carried a machine gun. She posed for a very revolutionary style photograph. And she released this tape. Let's play another tape that Robert Stone, you include in your documentary, Guerrilla, The Taking of Patty Hearst. And this is day 59 of her kidnapping, and this is a tape addressed to her parents.
Mom, Dad, tell the poor and oppressed people of this nation what the corporate state is about to do. Warn black and poor people that they're about to be murdered down to the last man, woman, and child. Tell the people that the energy crisis is nothing more than a means to get public approval for a massive program to build nuclear power plants all over the nation. Tell the people that the entire corporate state is, with the aid of this massive power supply, about to totally automate the entire industrial state to the point that in the next 5 years, all that will be needed will be a small class of button pushers. Tell the people, Dad, that the removal of expendable excess, the removal of unneeded people, has already started. I've been given the choice of 1, being released in a safe area, or 2, joining the forces of the Symbionese Liberation Army and fighting for my freedom and the freedom of all oppressed people. I have chosen to stay and fight. I have been given the name Tanya after a comrade who fought alongside Che in Bolivia. It is in the spirit of Tanya that I say, Patria o muerte, venceremos.
Patty Hearst recorded on the 59th day of her kidnapping. I'm interested in hearing what you both have to say about her temporary conversion or whatever as a revolutionary. I wonder like how you see that part of the story in your mind. Robert Stone, let's start with you. You made the new documentary.
Well, I'm not a psychiatrist, but I think it can be explained in 2 ways. The Stockholm Syndrome, which is something that's known to exist, where captives, people who are held hostage or kidnapped, tend to identify with their captors and sometimes even fall in love with their captors. This is known to happen. It's happened all over the world. I think that certainly happened to her early on. It doesn't explain everything, her complete transformation, but I think it probably provided a window into which she was indoctrinated with this kind of ideology. And you really got to understand it more like a cult. The SLA operated and increasingly operated as they went forward as a cult. And, you know, I think she joined a cult and totally bought into it for a time, as people do. And they were, you know, obviously, they were also living out this pop culture fantasy, this romantic fantasy. I mean, they met at the movies, you know.
The SLA members met at the movie?
Yeah.
What was the movie?
You know, they met at, I think it was a documentary about Attica that Russ Little was showing. Russ Little used to go around Berkeley showing political movies, and they all met at the movies, and they watched State of Siege repeatedly. It was interesting, at Sundance, when the film premiered, Patty Hearst was there and actually did the Q&A with me after the premiere, and she took me aside afterwards and said, you know, I've totally forgotten this, but when I was, you know, held in that closet for a time, and they were giving me all these books to read and trying to convince me of the rightness of their cause and everything, they dressed me up once in a costume and a wig and everything. They took me out to the movies to see a screening of State of Siege, you know, and it was just, I'd sort of gone out on a limb and suggesting the influence of this movie on them. But clearly, this was the template from which they were operating in many ways.
Tim Finley, what are your impressions of the temporary conversion or whatever that Patty Hearst temporarily underwent?
Well, I think Bob's right. You have to remember, first of all, that these were her peers, in effect, who kidnapped her. There was not that much difference between Patty and the people who were holding her hostage, except for DeFreeze, perhaps. They came from middle-class backgrounds. They had some of the same upbringing and so on and so forth. They went through the same pop period, if you will, of Berkeley and witnessing the revolution and the other adventures of the time. And, of course, there is that Stockholm syndrome. I've covered the Moonies and Scientology since and seen it over and over again. But finally, for Patty, there was also something very special. Now, Patty had always been the coddled member of Hearst's family. And suddenly she became the princess of the revolution. And frankly, she became conscious of that. I think she was, in the end, very much aware that she was now the most important urban guerrilla in the United States, however few urban guerrillas there may have been, and took that quite seriously. She had many opportunities to simply walk away from it and end it all and go home. But did not. She's had many opportunities later on to explain it all, and I don't think she has done that fully either.
Eventually there's a big shootout between the police in Los Angeles, where the SLA had moved to, and SLA members who were holed up in a house. The house caught on fire because of the tear gas that was used. Patty Hearst and the Harrises from the SLA were in another house. They were eventually arrested. Patty Hearst gets sentenced to 7 years in prison for her role in the bank robbery. Her sentence is commuted by President Carter to 22 months. She receives a full pardon from President Clinton just before he left the White House. Robert Stone, you interviewed two former SLA members for your documentary about Patty Hearst and the SLA. One of them was Mike Borton, and he's somebody who joined the SLA after the LA police confrontation with the SLA, and he was involved in a bank robbery in which a woman in the bank was shot. After you interviewed him for the movie, he and three others were arrested for that murder at the bank robbery years ago. And subsequent to him participating in your movie, he was put in jail, where he still is. And So I'm wondering what your reaction was after spending, you know, all this time talking with him about the past. And he really comes off as I think, quite lucid in your documentary. What your reaction was to seeing him now serving time for the action which he did not admit to, by the way, in the movie.
Well, he actually comes about as close as you can possibly get to an on-camera confession in the movie. And I knew that he was involved at the time. So, And he knew that this case was coming down the tracks, too.
I see.
So it wasn't a great surprise to me that they got arrested or that they pled guilty, because that was obviously they would be going to jail for a long time for murder. And they actually got off. Mike Borton, I think, is serving 6 years. So they got off quite lightly. So it wasn't entirely surprising. But I was in a bit of a bind, because I couldn't end my movie until this happened, and I knew it was coming. And I didn't know whether it was going to play out into some sort of big trial. I mean, the prosecutors wanted to put them on trial and bring in the entire history of the SLA and brand them as a terrorist group. This is, you know, shortly after 9/11, and they felt that was the way that they could get a conviction, because there wasn't very much forensic evidence against them. Which is why the case hadn't been solved for all these years. And they were going to put Patty Hearst, she was going to be the star witness to the whole thing. So I was in this bind of just waiting and waiting to see what was going to happen. And of course, miraculously, as I was finishing the film, this story that began in 1973 finally came to an end.
Do you think that the former members of the SLA see the story differently now than they did then?
Well, I mean, yes, I think they've all surprisingly agree, I think, with the central thesis of the film, which is that they got lost in this romantic fantasy world, which they lived out. And I think they see that now, and they recognize that now. They're very smart people, You know, and that really surprised me, because if you listen to the tapes, they just seem kind of crazy, and they're not. They're not at all. But, you know, like I say, I think all of them kind of brainwashed themselves to a degree. They also, a lot of the rhetoric and the theatrics of it was for show. You know, they wanted to get the attention, and they wanted to scare the pants out of the American public. And they thought by doing that they could incite a revolution by pretending that they were bigger than they actually were, that they would get, you know, support, that the whole thing would sort of snowball. It didn't really work that way. But the media definitely helped it and fueled it. So I think you can't separate the mass media from modern acts of political terrorism. They're absolutely intertwined and interrelated.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sherry.
Thank you.
Robert Stone directed the new documentary Guerrilla, The Taking of Patty Hearst. Journalist Tim Finley covered the story for the San Francisco Chronicle, co-wrote a book about it, and is featured in the film.